From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, the plight of Afghan refugee widows, plus Empty Streets. It's a somber short film about the struggles of a Marine trying to adjust to life back home. First, it was goodbye last night at AT&T Park in San Francisco.
Now batting number 25, Barry Bonds!
It was Barry Bonds' last game for the San Francisco Giants, but off the field, another notable baseball person was also saying goodbye. Nick Peters, baseball writer for the Sacramento Bee since 1988 and Northern California sports writer since 1961, was at AT&T Park to cover his last game. He joins us to recall some of the highlights and ups and downs of a 47-year-long career. Nick, welcome to Insight.
My pleasure.
A lot of pros and cons about Barry Bonds. Well, now he's played his final game for them. Are the Giants better or worse for having had Bonds all these years and paid him all that money?
Well, obviously they were better for the last 15 years because they're only the third team in baseball history to draw 3 million fans. And how many teams do you know that could draw 3 million with a losing season for 3 years in a row? I mean, he was the main attraction.
How good a player is Barry Bonds? When you look back over the greats of baseball, where does he rank?
He ranks among the top three or four. Steroid allegations notwithstanding, his numbers are remarkable. And people don't realize that he also was a tremendous fielder, whereas a person like Ted Williams was known as a fantastic hitter, but he didn't care about hitting. He didn't care about defense, about running, about anything else but hitting. But Barry was pretty much an all-around player. I would say of all the players I've watched over the years, only Willie Mays was better.
Well, you mentioned the steroid allegations. If those allegations were ever proven, would that cause Barry Bonds to fall down the list of baseball greats?
No, I don't think so, because people that know the game appreciated what he did even before these things came out. And his numbers are so far out of reach that there's no evidence that any performance-enhancing drug really contributed to them greatly. I think if they did anything, they prolonged his career and made him more effective at a later age than most players are. Mm. But he was a great player before.
Still, one thing stood out for me when I looked in the paper a few days ago. I saw a summary of Barry Bonds' years with the Giants and the number of home runs he hit every year. And with the exception of the last 3 years, when he's in his 40s and 1 year he was injured a lot, for the first 12 years, he was basically hitting between 35 and high 40s every year, except for 1 year when he hit over 70. And that, you can't help but wonder what happened that
course.
Year.
And he'll be labeled along with everybody else as part of the steroid era. And then we just have to accept that. I mean, Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa in 1998, everybody went crazy over what they were doing and their fabulous home run chase. And I think this might have been an incentive to Barry Bonds and to Mr. Victor Conti in his lab, the mad scientist, to come up with a means to give him a little more oomph.
What do you think Bonds is going to do next year? Do you think anyone will want him? I mean, he obviously has a lot of skills and he's sold a lot of tickets. But on the other hand, he's really not very popular outside of the Bay Area.
Exactly. And I think that's going to be the big problem. Teams will consider, well, we can use him as a designated hitter in the American League, and maybe he'll hit 30, 40 homers for us, but is it worth the risk of maybe altering clubhouse chemistry? And I think it's not going to be, he's not going to have as many options as he might think he has.
I see. What about the Giants? What do you think is ahead for them?
Well, they're going to get better. It's going to be some growing pains. They're not a better team simply because they got rid of Barry Bonds. They have to cultivate some talent. I mean, they have strong pitching, which is the first ingredient to success. And they have to build some younger players around them. They made a costly mistake the last 3 or 4 years, thinking that by surrounding Bonds with veteran players, it would be a cure-all. But it wasn't, because the veteran players they surrounded with them were also past their prime.
Do you think, though, that the main reason for keeping Bonds, or at least one of the main reasons for keeping Bonds, was more about selling tickets as he was approaching the home run record than it was about keeping the team viable?
I think there's a truth to that. They deny that vehemently, but I'm sure there's some truth to that. Because, you know, this nation has a compulsion with celebrity. And, you know, as compelling as Bonds is, he detracted from the focus which should have been on the team and building a strong team. And there was a method to the madness. They put 300 fannies in the seats, and they can justify it for that reason alone.
How did baseball become so Bonds-oriented? Was it driven by the media, or was it driven by the fans?
Well, media had a lot to do with it. Like I said, the media picked up on the fans' compulsion with celebrity, and it was all Bonds. For the last two or three years, every time you put on ESPN and Sports Highlight, it's what Barry Bonds did. You know, and I, as a veteran guy that loves the game, I didn't like that, but it's part of the way this country reacts. I mean, the big superstars get most of the attention. Michael Jordan, same way, and LeBron James now. It's just a fact of life. And as a veteran guy, I like the team concept. I enjoyed watching good teams more than great individuals.
Do you think Barry Bonds would have been covered differently if he had been around, say, in the early 60s when you were starting out as a sports writer?
Oh, yes, because he would have had not been allowed to have probably his enormous ego, because players in that era were a little more humble. And there were a lot of good ones then. There was Clemente, there was Aaron, there was Frank Robinson, there was Mays. I mean, you had a lot of competition. Now he and Alex Rodriguez are the big names, and they get the most of the publicity, and they hit home runs.
My guest is Nick Peters, Sacramento Bee baseball writer, retiring after a 47-year-long career covering sports in Northern California. His last game was last night at AT&T Park in San Francisco. What about baseball in general? How does it look today?
Oh, it looks great. I mean, obviously the steroid situation is getting a lot of interest, but attendance is up all over, and it's as popular as ever, because it's a different pace game. It doesn't appeal to the younger crowd as much because it doesn't have the action and the pizzazz of the NBA, and like I said, baseball hasn't done a great job of marketing the game itself. It's under a negative cloud because of the steroids. But people love the game. They remember going to the game 20, 30 years ago with their grandfathers and their fathers. And it's an enduring quality about baseball. You can go there, have an afternoon in the sun, relax, enjoy yourself, talk. You can't do that with other sports.
But it seemed for a while, and I'm talking really about the late 90s, that baseball was in jeopardy, and the strike was a problem. And did the home run races, possibly affected by steroids, and all these fancy new ballparks, did they save baseball?
And there's no question. Another factor, too, Cal Ripken was a very positive image, as he was going for his record of consecutive games. But most of it was attached to the Maguire-Sosa home run race in 98, and that really put baseball to the forefront again. But I think overall it doesn't have the overwhelming popularity to the younger people as the NBA does or the NFL does. But it's a great sport, and it's played every day, and it draws a lot of people. And as we have evidence of that in Sacramento. I mean, it's a wonderful little minor league ballpark and a good team. They're the Triple-A champions of the world, you know. So I mean, it's a good sport, and I know there are a lot of naysayers that condemn it because it doesn't have the same flow and action of the NFL or the NBA. But it's a great sport, and it still is America's pastime.
You're best known for writing about baseball, but you have over the years covered many sports. You've covered the NBA, the NFL, Cal football. What's your favorite sport?
Oh, baseball is unquestionably my favorite sport, yes.
Did it become your favorite sport because you were writing about it all the time, or did you write about it all the time because it was your favorite sport?
No, it was handed down from my dad. I mean, The first games we'd listened to on radio were Major League recreations. There was no Major League Baseball out here, but they'd have games on, and you'd hear about...
This was in San Francisco.
Yes, in San Francisco in the 40s and 50s. And I'd go to the minor league ballpark to see the San Francisco Seals. And I loved the pace of it. Now, maybe if I were growing up now in 2007, I'd have a different perspective, because maybe I would have been drawn more to the NFL or to the Kings, for instance, in Sacramento. But at that time, it was the only game in town.
What do you mean recreations of Major League Baseball games?
Well, they didn't have live feeds from the East. So they had a guy named Gordon McClendon, and they had another guy named Les Keiter. And they would sit in a studio, nationally, of course, and they would get tape reports of what was happening in the game, and they'd have sound effects like the ball hitting the bat. and you thought you were there. I mean, if you didn't know it was a recreation, you'd think you were at the ballpark. It's a long, high fly to right, and he had no clue. But I mean, he was told that on the tape, and he would relay it to his listeners, and that's how people on the West Coast got Major League Baseball in those days. And,
did you know that was a recreation?
Oh yes, they had to announce that.
Did that bother you?
No, not at all, because I wanted to listen to how Ted Williams and Jordan Maggio were doing, and I had no other option.
Well, by the 50s, Major League Baseball was heading west. Were you a Giants fan when they moved here?
Oh, yes, but there was some sentimentality, because the San Francisco Seals were a very good minor league team. They won the Pacific Coast League Championship the year before, and there was a tinge of nostalgia that they were going to be gone, but everybody was excited about the Giants coming out. You have to remember that, you know, I always say this, I feel very blessed, because in America, the golden age of sports was supposed to be the Roaring Twenties. You had Babe Ruth, you had Bill Tilden, Newt Rockne, but it's, for the West Coast, it was the 50s and 60s, because we were strictly a minor league territory, and the East Coast press didn't recognize what was happening out here. And everybody all of a sudden became a major league area when the Giants came out, and then the sandwiches, the Warriors came out from the NBA from Philadelphia. The Oakland A's came out from Kansas City, and the Raiders were created in 1960. So the only major league team we had when I was growing up was the 49ers, and they started in 1946.
As you covered the Giants over the years for the B and for others, is it ever hard to put aside the fact that you were born in San Francisco, longtime baseball fan? The Giants didn't come out here when you were young, but still, you were a baseball fan in San Francisco. Do you have to put that aside when you're writing about the Giants?
Well, you didn't when you first started out. I mean, I was enthused. I mean, I wanted them to win. Now there's more of a detachment. You're more professional. You go to a game, and, you know, who wins and loses is not as important. It's, you know, seeing a good game, having something interesting to write about, hopefully other than Barry Bonds.
My guest is Nick Peters, Sacramento Bee baseball writer, retiring after a 47-year-long career covering sports in Northern California. What's the rhythm of life for a baseball writer? Because baseball is a game that's played almost every day for a good chunk of the year. That must be tough.
Well, it's not tough. It's a matter of adjusting. Now I happen to like traveling a lot. So when I was growing up, my ambition was to be a baseball writer, and I could travel around the country for free on an expense account. And it took me a few years before I reached that goal, when I was hired by the East Bay Today and Oakland Tribune in 1979. I became a full-time traveling baseball writer, and it was nirvana. I mean, I would go to cities that I only dreamt about or read about, like spend two or three days in New York a couple times a year, Chicago. And I really enjoyed it, and I took advantage of it and made the most of it. I didn't consider it drudgery. It was like you get on a treadmill in mid-February to go to spring training, and then you'd get off at the end of October after the World Series, and then you'd have 3 or 4 months to indulge yourself in other travels.
Well, for every New York and Chicago, though, there is just at random, a Milwaukee or a Pittsburgh. No offense to those cities, but they might get a little old after doing them, going there year after year.
Oh, you can always find a nice restaurant, a nice jazz spot. You can, and there's always a ballpark. I mean, the baseball, it can be anywhere. It's a great game. Of course, when there were oppressive heat waves in St. Louis and Atlanta and Houston in the summertime, it wasn't so nice.
How do families fit into the life of a baseball writer?
Well, they have to make some sacrifices. And I'll tell you, my wife, Lise, and my daughter, Lisa, and I didn't spend as much quality time with them as I could have. And in those days, though, the job came first when I first started out, and nothing was going to keep me from doing what I wanted to do. Nowadays, the average baseball beat writer might do it for 3 or 4 years, and then he's got to go home. He's got to take care of the kids. You know, he won't commit himself to a long period of time doing it.
And then in the off season, you touched on this, but have you accrued as a traveling baseball writer so much comp time that you can basically just do what you want, or do you still have to go into the office and do whatever?
Well, nowadays you do, because with free agent signings and like I said before, the compulsion with celebrity, you have to keep your hand on the pulse all winter to see who's going to sign where. In the old days, it was wintertime was wintertime. You weren't interrupted. There was an occasional trade, and that was about it. But now baseball has become a year-round sport because as much attention is paid on where the free agents are going to end up next year. And that goes on in November, December, January.
We talked about how sports have changed, and certainly baseball, but it seems to me that sports journalism has changed as well. And one of the changes is the pulling back. We see it at the B, but I'm sure it's at the case at other papers too, mm-hmm. where there's less, the sending writers out less often to cover games. It's got to be a Bonds farewell. It's got to be a Bonds home run sort of thing, that sort of stuff. Have you seen that happening in general in sports journalism? And what does it mean?
Yes, and I see it happening. The people that make the decisions will tell you that baseball is not as popular anymore. And that's not the real reason. The real reason is economics. It costs more to cover a baseball team than it does any other team, because you're traveling every day. And it might cost $50,000, $60,000 a year to cover the Giants and the A's, where it's going to maybe cost $20,000 to cover the 49ers. So it's a matter of economics. And people say, well, we can get the same thing out of a wire report, so why do we have to have a reporter there? And it's true. I mean, you're going to get a story, but you're not going to get the access. You're not going to have the contacts. And as you pull away, you're recognized and appreciated by being there every day. And that's what I was the most proud of. I didn't take any time off. I didn't miss any games. And that's why I enjoyed it, and I built a reputation. Nowadays, it's much more difficult to do that.
Nick Peters is retiring after a 47-year-long career covering sports in Northern California. He covers baseball for the Sacramento Bee. His last game was last night at AT&T Park in San Francisco. You've been nominated for the Baseball Hall of Fame. Is that for your career-long coverage of baseball, or is it for something specific?
No, it's for coverage of baseball.
And who decides?
Well, the writers vote. Yeah. But it's usually a regional thing, and it usually goes to national baseball writers. And I've been pretty much local by choice. I mean, I grew up in San Francisco. I wanted to stay around here, and I was fortunate enough to be able to find work around here for so many years. But the award goes to people like Peter Gammons and people that are more nationally prominent. So I don't have my hopes high, but I'm very flattered that they put me up for it.
Let's listen to a clip of Peter McGowan, who's one of the owners of the San Francisco Giants. And this is where he's talking about whether or not San Francisco is a baseball town. Let's listen to that clip.
I think back when the Giants were headed for Tampa Bay, and, you know, this was a football town. It should be a football town. You know, great success of the 49ers. But Barry helped us make it a baseball town.
That's Peter McGowan. He was talking last night after the game in San Francisco, sounding quite choked up because he was the guy that brought Barry Bonds to San Francisco.
He was the only person last night that showed emotion. I mean, Bonds wasn't even around at the end of the game to say goodbye to people. He was gone. And we talked to players, and they said, well, we've accepted it. It's time to move on. But he was really legitimately choked up. I've never seen him like that. And he knew that it was the end of an era. And he waxed poetically about how Bonds actually saved the franchise. I mean, AT&T Park, for all practical purposes, is the house that Barry built, you know.
Mm. Do you think the McGowans, do you think that the San Francisco will revert to being a football town?
No, oh, well, it depends. If the 49ers have another run of Super Bowl victories and they get another Joe Montana, perhaps.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like I said, it all goes along with society. You have to have that key player, and that fuels the marketing, and that fuels the interest. And if the 49ers don't get another Joe Montana and they're a 500 team, it's not going to be a football town.
Mm.
Look what's happened to the Raiders. I mean, they were riding high in the 60s and 70s, and now their popularity is waning.
And finally, Nick, you like jazz too. Who do you like?
Oh, I grew up in the 50s when San Francisco was a pretty good hotbed of jazz, and I was very partial to Dave Brubeck and Paul Desmond. And I some of my best interviews are of jazz people. I mean, my favorite interview was of Sarah Vaughan. And I mean, to this day, I've never heard a singer like her or Ella. I mean, I was more of a 50s type guy.
When did you last write about jazz?
When I was at the Berkeley Daily Gazette, I used to do record reviews and jazz reviews.
Do you think now that you're retired from the daily sports business that you could go back to covering jazz or something like that?
Oh, I could if I chose to, but I probably will not. I have enough things to keep me busy, and I have three granddaughters that I want to spend time with.
And what is next for you? You've covered your last game, but in fact, you're not fully retired from the paper yet.
No, I'll probably write some baseball stories this winter, looking towards next year, and do some wrap-ups of this season. And the Bean wants me to do a wrap-up of how sports journalism has changed over the last 40, 50 years. So I'll be probably have a few stories, maybe to the end of the year, and that'll be it.
Well, you've earned your retirement when it comes. Nick Peters, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Nick Peters, Sacramento Bee baseball writer, retiring after a 47-year-long career covering sports in Northern California. His last game was last night in San Francisco. Thanks to KXJZ News reporter Ben Adler for the sound clips we used from last night at AT&T Park. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. We'll go out with a little bit of Coleman Hawkins. coming up, the plight of Afghan refugee widows. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from KXJZ, I'm Jeffrey Callis, and next time in Insight, Bay Area jazz singer Paula West is performing in Reno this weekend. She'll tell you how she interprets the Great American Songbook, and you'll hear clips from her albums. Plus, we follow up on the opening of the new Gallo Center for the Arts in Modesto. The Modesto Symphony Orchestra's music director, David Lockington, will tell you what it's like to perform in this new hall. And next week in Insight, the Sisters of Mercy celebrate 150 years in Sacramento. A mental health counselor who spent years working with Afghan refugee widows is currently a visiting scholar at UC Davis. Sarah Garrow Rubelt is working toward her doctoral degree in marriage and family therapy. Her focus as a counselor in St. Louis has been on such refugee-related issues as post-traumatic stress disorder, culture shock, and assimilation. She joins us to talk about the Afghan widows and the everyday struggles of all refugees. Sarah Garrow Rubelt, welcome to Insight.
It's a pleasure being here.
How did you come to work with Afghan refugee widows for so long?
Well, My work started as an intern when I was in the research methodology department of St. Louis University, and I helped a professor work with Bosnian refugees doing a research about the resettlement process. And then soon after that, I applied for an internship at the International Institute in St. Louis, and I was able to work with Afghan refugee widows coming in St. Louis at that time.
A lot of people from Afghanistan in St. Louis?
Yes, not as much as Bosnian refugees. That's the largest population of refugees in St. Louis, but fairly enough enough to basically have a group of women who were in need of support group and individual counseling and family therapy.
Were these women that you were working with, were they refugees because of post-9/11, or are these refugees from all the various things that have gone on in their country before then?
Definitely, I would say from events long before then. People who were displaced long before in Pakistan, in neighboring countries of Afghanistan.
Why widows?
Majority of the men in Afghanistan were basically recruited for fighting, and many of them were killed. If they cooperated, they were sent off, and many of them were never seen again. And if they stayed, many of them were killed during bombings and combat.
What would have happened to these women, the widows, if they had stayed in Afghanistan?
Well, they basically would have suffered from not being able to work, not being able to support their families, to be able to get an income, to earn an income. So many of them had to flee in order to survive.
So there wasn't much for them in Afghanistan, but it doesn't follow from that that you therefore feel comfortable, welcomed, or even thrive in the place that you find yourself. How did the women from Afghanistan do in general in St. Louis?
That's a very good question. Definitely, my work involving this population was about the struggles that they faced upon arrival to St. Louis. As you know, myself as an immigrant, I know how difficult it is to have to come to a new environment, learn the language, and basically learn the way of life. And for many of the refugees, they found quite a great deal of shock to deal with the reality that was awaiting for them in the resettlement country.
My guest is Sarah Garrow-Rubelt. She's a visiting scholar at UC Davis who worked for 5 years with Afghan refugee widows in St. Louis. She's a mental health counselor working toward a doctoral degree in marriage and family therapy. On Monday, she gives a public talk about her work with the Afghan refugee widows. That's at the International House in Davis. You mentioned that you're an immigrant and you're from Iran.
Yes.
Which is a neighboring country to Afghanistan.
Absolutely.
Are there cultural similarities between Iran and Afghanistan?
Definitely, yes. Very similar cultural similarities in both the language as well as the food, the way of life interaction.
Did that help you work with the refugee widows?
Absolutely, it did. It did.
Tell us what these women did in St. Louis once they arrived. How did they, what did they do? What was their life like?
Well, for many of them, they had dealt with a great deal of pain, grief, and loss of family and loved ones. And upon arrival, they were dealing with a great deal of trauma. However, you know, as it is normal in case of war trauma refugees, because they are involved in the experience of fight or flight, they're not able to really deal with the trauma. So upon resettlement, as they begin to face new challenges, that's when you start seeing what the trauma has done to an individual.
What does it do to you?
Well, it certainly takes away the sense of safety and security. It adds to your uncertainty of the world and what could happen tomorrow. For the refugee, Afghan refugee woman, as they arrived in St. Louis, they weren't able to understand how much more struggle they have to go through before they could actually comfortably live. They had to immediately learn English, you know, start ESL classes. They had a short period of time before they had to go start working. Well, many of them never worked. They had worked, actually. I take that back. Of course, they worked before the Taliban. Many of them were teachers, educated individuals who contributed to their society. But because of the Taliban, they weren't allowed to pursue their career. So that transition was a very difficult challenge for them to go straight to work, especially in a minimum wage position and leaving behind their many children.
You said that that for many people in that situation, they don't feel safe. But if you go to another country where you don't speak the language, at least at first, and your skills don't easily transfer, and you have no money, then chances are you're going to live in a neighborhood that's not the safest.
Exactly.
Which I would guess would make things worse, or at least doesn't help.
Yes, exactly. I have to say, I have to give credit to International Institute of St. Louis for doing a great job of orienting the newcomers of what to expect in the St. Louis metropolitan area. Because, as you said, there is a great deal of dangers when you don't know the environment, you don't know what to expect, and you don't have a great way of transportation or financial security to be able to get around. So the orientations had helped, but many incidents would still happen because as a foreigner, not knowing the language, being in a new environment, you don't really know what to expect. And unfortunate things did happen quite often.
Did any of them say to you, I just can't do this?
Yes.
So what do they do?
As my job as a therapist was always to focus on their strength. To me, these women are heroes. They gave up so much. They sacrificed so much for the future of their children. They did this because of freedom. They did this because of finding a better life. And that takes courage. That takes strength. And having done that, being where they were, they already had all that it took and all that it takes to continue their success and achievement in living a life in a new country. And so that within itself certainly helped to put their lives into perspective.
When you think back to all the Afghan refugee widows that you worked with, was there anything that they had in common that they tended to like about America, even be pleasantly surprised about, and anything that they had in common that they really struggled with here and that was maybe a shock?
Yes, definitely. Well, I think what they loved about it, and this is what they told their children, was that the sky's the limit here. You can work hard and do whatever it takes to find a better way of life. For many of them, they felt that it was over for them, that life, for some reason, was ending for them, but beginning for their children. So they felt that they did their responsibility in terms of bringing their kids here so that they could have a better life. But they weren't so much happy with the limitations that they themselves were faced with here. Having no funding that can continue on sponsoring them so that they could learn a career that they would be satisfied with, so that they could perhaps have a greater quality of life and not just struggle to meet, you know, to make ends meet survive for today.
Did any ever go back to Afghanistan?
Very few, and only in the circumstances of, you know, a loved one that was in terms of being reunited with a lost loved one, or someone whose elderly parents were sick and ill and they had to go back. Very few, but they did go back, and it was really fascinating talking with them about their experiences going back and seeing Afghanistan from a different perspective.
Mm. You were born in Iran. How old were you when you came to the United States?
I was 13.
And what brought you here?
Well, I have a quite fascinating, interesting life story myself. I was adopted by my aunt and uncle. My biological mother died in a car accident when I was very young. Almost 5 and a half. And basically what happened was through the various situations, circumstances, it was better for my father to give me to my mom's sister, biological sister, who lived in America, had an American husband, and they loved us dearly and wanted us to live with them.
I remember when I moved to the United States, this was in 89, when I would meet people from Iran, they tended to tell me that they were Persian.
Yes.
I guess because they didn't want to publicize in America that they were from Iran. And obviously there were tensions between the United States and Iran at that time, and there are still tensions today. In fact, they seem to be getting worse again. What's it like being living in America when you come from a country that is at loggerheads with the government of the United States?
Yes, that's a wonderful question. I'm so glad you brought that up. Absolutely. Being Persian, for many Iranians is a sense of pride, because to discuss that, you are putting the focus on the cultural values and positive cultural values that many Iranians can be proud of. Being Iranian, especially with everything that's often on the media and the focus on, is something that is more associated with negative things. And I think for many of Iranians who were frustrated with that generalization, it was really difficult. It's really difficult to connect with people when you're trying to explain to them that it's different. Being Iranian is not being associated with all the negative things that they're hearing.
A lot of people in other countries outside of Iran say Iran is trying to build nuclear missiles, and Iran's president says we're not. It's our right to build our own nuclear energy. I don't know if you have any special knowledge, if you talk to people in Iran, but what's your take on that? Do you think Iran is building nuclear missiles?
You know, I have no idea, but I do know that there is really no way of knowing these things. I tend to try to stay objective. I don't want to believe everything I read. I don't want to believe everything I hear. I think that there's always two sides to a story, and I think it's important to be open-minded and want to learn both sides. And I am happy that even though the dialogue that took place wasn't necessarily the best, but I'm happy that there is at least opportunities that opens this type of dialogue for better understanding and clarifications.
And do you ever go back to Iran?
Yes, I do. Last time I was there, I think it was 4 years ago, but I do plan on going back, and I have a German husband that I someday dream of taking there. So,
do you plan to go soon?
I don't know how soon, but in the next couple of years, yes.
I see. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for coming in and joining us today and talking about your work with Afghan refugee widows.
Thank you.
Sarah Garrow-Rubalt is a visiting scholar at UC Davis. She's worked for 5 years with Afghan refugee widows when she lived in St. Louis. She's a mental health counselor working toward her doctoral degree in marriage and family therapy. On Monday at noon, she gives a public talk about her work with Afghan refugee widows. Go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight, for more information. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, Empty Streets. It's a film about a Marine struggling to adjust to life back home. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tell us what you think about Insight or send us suggestions. Our email address is insight@capradio.org. Empty Streets is a new short film about a Marine struggling to adjust to life at home after serving in the Middle East. It's a feature film, but based on the journals of a real U.S. Marine. Empty Streets was shot in Lodi, Sacramento, and Modesto. To the key people behind the film, join us by phone. They are Paul Booth, who is director, co-writer, and producer, and Eli Kalilakani, who is co-writer and producer. The film is based on his journals. Paul, Eli, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Paul, could you tell us the story behind this? How did this film come to be made?
I really just wanted to explore loneliness. I was lonely one night on a train to Vancouver, and I was missing my girlfriend and thinking about my best friend Eli and some of the things he went through, and I just thought the best way that I could explore loneliness would be to look at some of the things that him and I went through, mainly him, and I just wanted there to be a message to the film, so I decided to backbone the film about his PTSD.
Eli, you served in the U.S. Marines.
Yes, I did.
Tell us about your service. Where did you spend your time in the Marines, and what did you experience?
Basically, I was pre-Iraq, Afghanistan. I went overseas, various different places. I was an intelligence specialist, so I experienced a lot of things personally and through other veterans as well. just traveling and having, because of my security clearance, I had the opportunity to see a lot of things that I guess the general average public doesn't really see.
And could you give us an example of that?
A specific example? Well, just being overseas. Okay, when we went over, I spent some time over in Kuwait, and just being over there for training, just being able to help out with the populace. And a particular problem at that time, it was we were trying to get the UN inspectors into Iraq, and it was an interesting experience. But because of my clearance, I'm not allowed to discuss too many details regarding certain events.
Now, Eli, you were born and raised in Hawaii.
Yes, that is correct.
Paul, you spent a lot of time in Hawaii, but you're not actually from there originally. Is that right?
No, I was actually born in Southern California, and my father moved us to Hawaii when I was 10, and I lived here from 1991 until 2005 when I moved to California.
Yes. Now, the cast is Hawaiian, but the film was shot in the Central Valley, Lodi, Sacramento, Modesto. Why all these Hawaiian people involved in a film that was shot in the Central Valley?
Well, the main actor, Anthony Haviland, was a very enthusiastic friend of mine, very enthusiastic about wanting to have a chance to do a short film. And he'd done a lot of extra work and stunt work, but he'd never had a chance to carry a piece. So it was mainly just giving a friend an opportunity. The main actress was the same way. She had experience as a model and behind the scenes. And had never had an opportunity to be, an important part of what the project was. So I was just kind of looking for very fresh collaborators. My cameraman was from Canada, so it was a real, what we did was kind of like, to me, was like playing jazz. There was no egos. There was picking up each other's cues. There was, knowing when to shut up with each other. It was just a really beautiful experience.
Now, these two Hawaiian actors who play the lead roles in Empty Streets, had they moved to California, or did they come over from Hawaii for the film?
You could go ahead and answer that, Eli.
Okay.
Well, we actually all came out over to California to, participate in this project that we all were very passionate about, but we are still residents here in Hawaii.
Okay. But despite all these people moving out, you had to make the film on a fairly small budget. Paul, how much money?
It was a couple of $1,000s. It was enough to, basically fly the people in. My cameraman pretty much was able to get here for free because his dad had been an Air Canada pilot for like 20 years.
Uh-huh.
But it was just enough to eat, sometimes not eat. It was basically $2,000 to $3,000.
Okay, we're going to hear a clip from the movie Empty Streets. Eli, could you just tell us a little bit about the main character, this young soldier who's struggling to adjust to life back home? Tell us who he is.
Well, Johnny is based off my persona. When I returned back home, I was very lost. I didn't quite adjust into society. And I was self-medicating to try to just, ground myself, to bring myself back to the fact that I wasn't overseas. And Johnny is myself and other veterans basically coming together to where they have a problem just adjusting from being in a combat situation or being extremely pushed emotionally and coming back here to, the United States and trying to adjust back to normal everyday living.
Okay, let's hear this clip then. It's from the movie Empty Streets.
The last thing that a 19-year-old should really worry about is if my gunfire is hitting innocent civilians. Yeah. Enemy casualties, they say it doesn't matter. They say they don't care, right? But they do. Don't they? When it comes down to it, when a man dies, he bleeds and he cries the same as an American.
Paul, most of the film is shot at night, and
yes.
it's in very modest locations, you know, like a 7-Eleven parking lot, those kinds of places.
Right.
But you shot it in three different places, three different cities. Why did you shoot it in three different cities when it was mainly shot at night in very modest outdoor locations?
Well, it was really, and I say this in a very respectful way, but it was very hard to get permission to shoot in Sacramento. Modesto was a glorious town that I recommend to any filmmaker that wants to shoot. They made it very easy for us to get locations. They got us permits. They, the film commissioner actually gave me her cell phone and said, if any police hassle you, you can call me at 3 a.m. and have them speak with me. The reason for shooting in the Lodi liquor store was because our Modesto location fell through, probably a day or two before we were supposed to shoot that scene. So it was just a last-minute thing that fell into place.
Eli, the film Empty Streets is based on your own experiences and comes from your own thinking about what you went through and what you observed. When you look at the film today, do you feel like it is an accurate representation of what was in your mind?
Many times during the filming, I have to take a break and walk away because it was reliving the whole experience. It's a low I've never felt before, and to actually see it again, it was borderline a nightmare for me at times. I did, you know, had a very emotional experience going through this film. But yes, to answer your question, very much so. It was very, very realistic. It just blew me away, and I was more, and I still am more than proud of this project. You know, it's just great. This is great.
Paul, there's some pretty cool music in the film. How do you set about getting the rights to interesting music when you've got a tiny budget?
You know, I can honestly say, and when I say spirits, I don't mean anything religiously, but I believe in that spirit of when you put out your heart and your intention and your passion. We were just so blessed to have met some people that run the Willie Nelson Peace Institute, so they let us use a song from Willie Nelson. The blues legend that just any blues fan loves, Charlie Musselwhite. I was fortunate enough to become friends with him just through attending his shows and talking to him about the blues. That beautiful Indian music you played to start the segment, Vishwa Mohan Bhatt, I went to a concert of his and just walked up to him and we started talking. So there really was no getting rights. There was a making a friendship, and there was a share of passion, and just really the way music, that to me is just the universal language.
You have a screening of the film coming up pretty soon, don't you, Paul?
Yes, Monday, October 1st, down in Riverbank, California, at the Galaxy 12 Theaters. It's going to be part of the NorCal Film Festival, which is going to have a program of films that starts at 7 p.m., but I'm told that Empty Streets is going to show around 9:30 p.m., so there will be some other films playing with it, but there will be a Q&A and all that stuff.
Okay, well, thank you both very much. Paul and Eli, by the way, are joining us from Hawaii, but the film Empty Streets was shot in Lodi, Modesto, and Sacramento. Paul Booth, co-writer, producer, and director. Eli Kalilakani, co-writer and producer. Thank you both for joining us.
No, thank you. Thank you very much.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more information about the guests and topics you hear on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Coming up on KXJZ, new home prices have fallen sharply, and there's still a glut of new empty homes in the market. That story in the day's business news next on Marketplace. Today's associate producer was Linnea Edmeyer. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Running the board today, though, is Nick Brunner. Our senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us.